Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience with Darren and Mark and a special guest.
Hello and welcome to the Fan Experience Experience, the podcast that explores the power of engagement in football and in other sports. Join me, Mark Bradley, and my co-pilot, Darren Young, as our guests tell us their stories and share what they've learned. In season two of the podcast, we're exploring fan engagement post-COVID and uncovering new ideas to help your club, league, or association to prosper amidst all of the uncertainty as we emerge from this pandemic. So, I mean, talking about uncertainty, Darren, I mean, today, obviously these podcasts go out in the future, but the day that we record them, as often as not, brings some new exciting challenge for football, does it not?
It certainly does. I've just been trying to work out how many clubs fewer can have fans than they could last week. So it's been an interesting little piece of work, but it's definitely less.
Yeah, well, Sunderland, as you know, my beloved club, having previously decided that a run of losses wasn't as interesting as a run of relegations, have now decided to go on a run of not actually playing at all. So that's been the kind of topical point at this end. And this is a time of uncertainty. And as those listeners know, what we're hoping to do is to try and help clubs ready themselves for returning after COVID with some new ideas and some new ways of thinking. And in this episode, we're going to be talking to Jeff Pearson from the University of Manchester. Jeff's a leading academic and researcher in the areas of policing, crowd behaviour, human rights and sport. And for those, and this includes myself, who are unfamiliar with the word ethnography, Jeff explores these issues by taking the point of view of the subject of the study. And this has led to some unique experiences, which we'll get to soon. But first of all, welcome, Jeff.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Oh, it's really nice to have you. I mean, for me, the first question is, how did you get in to the particular disciplines that you teach? Where did the story start?
Well, it's a combination of an interest that I had in football and football crowds from being a teenager. I was absolutely fascinated with football crowds. I was a football obsessive. And whenever I had the opportunity to do something academic that I could apply to football, then I'd do that. And then I started doing a law degree at the University of Lancaster back in the 1990s, yep, with all the intention of becoming a solicitor, and found myself doing research on the impact of legislation around football hooliganism, as it was then called. And that led on to a PhD. So it was a combination of my academic interest in law and also my personal interest in football.
And of course, the most important point is you're a United follower, aren't you?
Yes, I went to my first United game back in 1977, and I'm currently a season ticket holder, even though I've not been to a match since the COVID outbreak in the mid-March of 2020.
Well, let me introduce you to a Walsall fan. Hi, Darren.
Yeah, I can't go either, Jeff, to any matches, but that's a good thing at the moment. So, no, to be fair, we've just won three games on the trot, so maybe it's not.
So, Darren, do you want to fire off with a question?
Yeah, Jeff. Well, I mean, obviously, I'd explain how you got into this, but I'd love to know how it all started in terms of what was the first project that you were involved in.
Well, when I was completing my undergraduate degree at Lancaster, I looked at the impact of a piece of legislation called the Football Offences Act, which is the piece of legislation that was introduced post Taylor report. Takes criminal offence to run on the pitch, to throw anything in a stadium, to engage in indecent or racist chanting. And I was just interested in how that worked and the extent to which it was enforced. And that got me looking at both crowd behaviour and also the way in which law and policing and crowd behaviour interacted. It was a relative success, and an opportunity came to do a PhD at Lancaster. And so I decided I was going to extend this a little bit, look at legal responses to football crowd violence. And the way I was going to carry out that was by doing ethnographic observations with fans of Blackpool Football Club, who were one of the local, they were in what is now League One then, as indeed they are now. And so I locked up at the old Bloomfield Road, on, stood on the terraces and started watching them for 3.5 years, making notes when I got back and you know, assessing how they reacted to different forms of policing and different pieces of legislation.
It is a fascinating approach, and we'll obviously delve a little deeper in this, Jeff. And comparing it with the approach that we take, obviously a non-academic organisation, but the work that we do, it involves actually someone being there. Sometimes it's a real fan. For example, the disabled fan experience programs that we run with the EFL. Sometimes it's a kind of an experienced assessor. And whereas we wouldn't be at the same club week after week after week, we've probably done over 2,500 individual assessments. And it's remarkable that even in Denmark and Holland, the same sort of issues appear. And I think that, you know, that you could summarize it up by, you know, while wanting to engage, you could actually say that maybe football doesn't want to engage. But over the past 15 years, the approach is generally coercive. It's not an engaging approach. So, you know, your perspective on that is going to be really interesting. So how did this be? There's a lot of trust building involved in this exercise, I imagine.
To a certain extent, originally my research was entirely, or my methodology was entirely covert. So the people I was observing didn't know that I was doing a PhD. They didn't know I was writing a thesis. They didn't know I was observing them in you know, like that at all. So it wasn't a case that I had to win trust as an academic in the field. I had to win trust as a fellow football fan.
No, and that was the point I was getting to. How easy was that process? I mean, you know, because you would assume that the groups of people that go to the games, they all know each other quite well. So, you know, did you have a backstory prepared, or did you just kind of appear one day? You know, what were those first few matches like?
Well, they were a learning experience. I'd had some experience as an undergraduate. I'd watched a few matches just as a football fan. So I knew where I wanted to stand on the terraces, where it would give me a good observation, where I'd get to know people. I knew where the pubs that the fans went to for home matches in particular were. So it really was just the case of wearing something that would make me fit in, and turning up and just hanging around and being there regularly. And, you know, football fans, obviously, you know, we make personal friendships and go with members of a family to matches. But quite a lot of it is just about knowing faces. It's about seeing people that are there week in, week out. And gradually you talk to them more. And it may well be that you've been sat in front of or behind of another fan that you know a huge amount about their views on your football team. You talk to them every week, sometimes more than once a week, but you don't actually know what their name is. Mm-hmm. They're just one of those faces that you see all the time, and really that's what I wanted to do. And I had a bit of a backstory, but it didn't need to be much of one. I essentially said I was a student at Lancaster University. They concluded I was probably from Blackpool. And, you know, they didn't really need to know that I was doing a PhD. So there wasn't an awful lot of outright deception that was going on here. It was mainly hiding some important truths.
Yeah, one of the problems I have, Jeff, when we do what's effectively mystery shopping, so obviously the club don't know we're going and we're behaving in the way a fan would, and one of the things I love it, apart from the one thing I dread, is if somebody comes up to me and asks me a question about the centre forward or something that is just that only a really, really well educated fan of the club would know. Did you have any incidents like that at the start?
Not really, because, you know, people don't in my experience, if you are a new face in an area, those questions don't get addressed to you. They get addressed to people that they normally address those questions to. And as you become more aware of what is going on, I found I could be more vocal in terms of which players I would get behind and which players I wouldn't. And then I tended to get the questions, but by then, you know, I knew as much as anybody else in terms of the team that were playing in front of us at the time. And you know, football, one of the things I discovered about football fandom is just how different fans are, about how you can't say that a particular club, for example, has a set fan culture. There's people go to football matches for many, many different reasons. They go to be with friends, they go to be with family, they go to have a drink, they go because they want to go to every single match, they go to collect merchandise, they go because they are really interested in the technical side of football, they go because they've got nothing better to do. And, you know, a lot of people have very different, very varying knowledge bases. There's a lot of new fans at football. A lot of people will move into an area and decide to take in the new club. So it wasn't something I was particularly concerned about. Obviously, when I started going more regularly, particularly to away matches, it was expected I would have greater knowledge of things like the chants that people would get involved in, because there are fewer places to hide at away matches than home matches. But it was a process of evolving into my research role, which is a part of ethnographic approaches to studying social fields, that you feel your way into them, you become more confident, and you become more of an insider the longer you're there.
I only got found out once, and I remember I went to a Coventry game at the Ricoh Arena, and I was standing next to some people and they kept talking to me and I sort of kept nodding and agreeing and everything. And then eventually they said, "You're not a Coventry fan, are you?" And I said, "Well, what makes you say that?" And they said, "You're too happy." So I sort of had to half break my cover with them, because they'd sort of worked it out.
I mean, there have been incidents when I've been doing covert research, and you know, I've not done covert research now since 2007, 2008 was probably the last time I did covert research. But there have been incidents. Usually abroad, where I've been mistaken for an undercover police officer, yeah, or where I've been mistaken for a journalist. The latter is a lot more concerning, because football fans have generally fewer qualms about being aggressive towards an undercover journalist than they do to an undercover police officer. But no, generally it was an enjoyable and, for the most part, without stress experience. There were incidents, there were times when I feared for my safety, and there were things that I did to make myself fit in, including shaving off hair, getting an earring, taking up smoking, these kind of things. But you know, it was something that I never felt I was about to be revealed as being a researcher at any stage.
So if we bring us to the present day, Jeff, and in your work, we're in a situation now where, you know, football clubs may have actually gone more than 18 months before they can get back to kind of any semblance of the normality that we all knew and loved. We would have hoped that it's a period for reflection as well. So I guess it's we'd love to have several hours to talk about what you do, because your work is fascinating. But if there were two or three messages you'd want to get across to, let's say, the football industry, so we could be talking the owners, the authorities, we could be talking people at individual clubs, what would they be? What would you urge football to reflect on from your own work on fan behavior, crowd control, and the way that, that different fan groups are perceived?
Well, I mean, I think it's clear to the football authorities, those running the leagues and the governing bodies and the federations, just how fundamental football fans are to the product, as they might call it, of football. I mean, I don't know how widely this experience is, and presumably there is research going on about it, but I've not watched a single match as a neutral since lockdown. I've had no interest at all in watching games other than my own team, where there have been no fans. It's just such a lesser product. I have such little interest in it. And, you know, I would expect that that has been reflected in things like viewing figures. We know it's been reflected in the value of TV rights. And I think the football authorities and the clubs may have to start valuing fans and what they bring to the product an awful lot more. And start thinking on a more practical basis about how you manage situations like this where you have pandemics. Unfortunately, a lot of clubs have blotted their copybooks by, you know, not refunding season ticket money, for example, when this started, and breaching competition law by doing so. And, you know, clubs need to stop doing this, because they need to realise that the fans are incredibly valuable to what they want to sell to their sponsors, their advertisers, to their TV markets. So that's the first thing I think that has come out of this, and hopefully fans will be more valued by the football industry generally, and less taken for a ride, I guess. Yeah. In terms of those policing the game, again, I think what we've seen, particularly through some of the trial games with small numbers of spectators, is just how engaged, how well football fans will engage with authorities when they think that regulations imposed upon them are legitimate.
Yeah.
So I've been to, I went to a trial match actually at Blackpool, funnily enough, and, you know, saw the fans following the rules, following the regulations. Why? Well, because they thought they were legitimate. Mm-hmm. A lot of the laws around football are not perceived to be legitimate. Laws relating to drinking alcohol inside the pitch, not being able to persistently stand, these kind of laws are generally not seen as legitimate by fans. And it's why fans break them so regularly. And it will be interesting to see what happens in terms of standing at football matches, particularly because, of course, the SGSA is about to produce its final report into safe standing at football, and I've been involved in that project. And the interim report essentially said safe standing areas were safer than standing in normal seated areas. Now, if the final report says that, then for me, that's probably the last blockage towards bringing back not old-fashioned terracing, but bringing back standing at football matches. And by that, I'm not even talking about rail seating. I'm talking about rails. You know, that is potentially going to be absolutely huge football, particularly at the elite level.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll have to see, because that's all been put back by COVID. But that could be a quite fundamental change to hit the game when fans come back, hopefully at the start of, in large numbers, hopefully at the start of next season. Yeah, they could be coming back into football stadiums with new standing areas.
Yeah, can I ask that then? Because one of the things that fascinates me, when I knew you were coming on the podcast, one of the things I really wanted to sort of to ask you about was the fans themselves. Because as Mark said earlier, you know, if fans in realistic numbers don't go back until, you know, March at the very earliest into stadiums, then that's going to have been 12 months. How different do you think fans will be after a year of not going to games?
Well, first of all, I'd be amazed if we're back in large numbers by March.
Yeah, at the earliest, yeah.
I suspect we will start to see small numbers of fans nationwide going back around Easter time. I don't think, you know, if any football stadium is full by the end of the season, I think that would be a considerable result. Mm. And, you know, it's really interesting to see what will happen, how fan culture will change. Players will have come and gone, as will their chants. Fans will have had time to reflect, and that may well change behaviour, may well change the tone of chants, it may well change how fans consume the football product, for want of a better expression. Some fans won't come back. For one reason or another. But other fans that may be casual fans will realise just how important football is to them, and they may start to attend more regularly. There will be fans with money in the bank as a result of lockdown, and there will be fans who've lost their jobs. So when people look around in the football stadiums at the end of August 2021, they will probably see a lot of different people. They will see people missing, they'll see new people, and that will, you know, it will affect the sounds in particular of football and the feel of football for those fans. Exactly how nationally football fandom will change, I think we'll just have to see.
Have you got a thought, Jeff, on what, and this is something we talk about a lot, on whether the numbers will go back to where they were, or do you think they'll be higher or lower?
I genuinely do not know. Because I think the turnover of fans will be great, because I think there will be both economic and social and emotional reasons why people can or can't go to matches, or why they could upgrade their ticket or have to go to fewer matches. And it's just looking at the balance of that. And I guess we have yet to see the economic impact of COVID. Mm-hmm. Let's see what happens in terms of unemployment, for example, in terms of redundancies. We've also, of course, got Brexit. You know, people will lose jobs as a result of that in the first part of this year as well. Again, you know, that could have a huge impact on the numbers of people attending matches in certain parts of the country that are most affected, you know, areas in manufacturing in particular. So, you know, it is going to be different, but I wouldn't want to bet now whether your average attendance is going to go up or is going to go down. I suspect, as usual, it will be a very local changes which will be happening, and at some clubs it may be attendances will go up, and at some clubs attendances will go down. Of course, some of the clubs will be in different divisions than they were when when fans were last watching them, and again, that will always have an impact on attendances.
I think as we kind of approach the end of the podcast, Jeff, just kind of widening the theme a little. Over the past 12 months, we were delighted to be asked by Football Club Barcelona's Innovation Hub to write a certificate, an introduction to fan engagement, and of course with both my kids, the kind of higher education parts of their lives, and my other half is doing an MSc in criminal justice and victimology. So I'm beginning to learn about, you know, academic how research is done academically, the different forms of research. Like I say, you know, words like ethnography, and there's one thing that I found that was really interesting at the start of the project of writing the certificate. I thought, right, I'm going to research. Do as much desk research as I can into the topic of fan engagement and related areas. And your name came up straight away, as did Owen West's and other people. And my wife had studied Clifford Stott, you know, who's another name that that we follow and whose work we study with interest. And it was where, if you can imagine, you know, the Walsalls, the Sunderlands, my son's team, Bradford City's of this world. Some of the insights that I picked up when I read through those academic papers were absolutely of 100% value to some of the non-elite clubs that we work with. And I wondered how you felt as an academic about the challenge of kind of public engagement, for want of a better term. How do you get your findings and your research? I mean, you know, we know pushing forward inch by inch, that, you know, the whole movement of just moving things forward. How do you get those findings and those learnings and those conclusions to the front line, for want of a better term, to people running clubs?
Well, it's always been a challenge. I used to be the director of the football MBA at Liverpool, and trying to get clubs on board to accept free expertise from MBA students could be really, really difficult. And you know, some clubs are better than others, but a lot of clubs just are not very good at dealing with evidence and dealing with science. I think the way in which club owners come into the job and chief executives are appointed is often not very good. And I think that is reflected in in how clubs engage with their fan base and how they engage with science. My main aim is to engage with governing bodies,
yep,
and to engage with the police in terms of how football crowds are managed. Mm. In terms of football governing bodies, again, it's very hit and miss. Football governing bodies historically have been quite poor in terms of responding to evidence. We're seeing that, for example, with the Football Association and the debates about concussion and heading the ball. We've known those dangers for decades now, and action is only just being taken. So to a certain extent, with governing bodies, it's just being lucky and being there all the time, like doing your observations with football fans. The longer you are there for, the more likely you're going to get what you want. You're going to get those opportunities. You're going to find that data. And that's what's really happened in terms of the Football League. The Football League have come to the conclusion they want a study done on improving police and security at matches, and we've been doing it for long enough that they approached us. In terms of the police, it really is a case of engaging with the police and trying to work with them. And ultimately, some forces will respond very positively, and some forces won't. Some forces are bought into the idea of evidence-based policing, and other forces aren't. And really, all you can do is plug away. And that is part of the job of being an academic. It's about trying to get your research out there into the real world to change things for the better, because there's very little point in just sitting in your ivory tower and writing papers that only a handful of other academics will read and won't actually ever change anything.
But Jeff, listen, the time's ahead of us, but thanks so much for spending, a bit of your time with us. You know, for the few people that work in the university and higher education world, I know that workloads have doubled this year as you're producing all the different types of learning, the live learning and the pre-recorded learning. And I know it's difficult for you, but I do want to say a big thank you from me and for Darren for making such a positive contribution to this discourse, because I think we are getting there, I think little by little, and I think it'll also interest you as well that some of your former students are now in positions of influence at Liverpool, and I do believe that the current CEO of the Accra Hearts of Oak in Ghana is one of them, and he was in touch the other day.
Yes.
for a chat. So it's clear that these ideas are getting out there, and there's a lot of people really having a spring clean, and trying to think about new ways of doing it. And I know, Darren, you've loved that. I mean, Darren, we've had some fascinating conversations, but this has got to be at the top of the tree, as far as I'm concerned.
So much to think about. It's incredible. There's so many things that you've brought up, Jeff, that I hadn't even thought about. And it's certainly there's a long road ahead, but I think people need to start taking notice of some of this clear evidence that's out there, and I really hope they do.
Well, Blackpool, you mentioned, we'll finish on Blackpool. Walsall won't be playing Blackpool this season because they're not in the same division. We were going to be playing Blackpool in a couple of weeks, but half our squad have COVID, so that's not happening. And it was, funnily enough, the last away visit assessment I undertook with a Blackpool fan was at a game in League One last season, and three of us actually went in there, and the son of my friend was stopped and actually had his wallet searched. Nobody told him why, nobody asked him if they could look at his wallet, and we're presuming it was for a pyro, but again, it didn't leave the best possible impression. So listen, thanks again, Jeff. I hope you have a fantastic Christmas, and I hope 2021's better for us all than it's been this year. So thanks very much for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me on, and I hope we're all back to our respective football teams sooner rather than later.
Hear, hear. Definitely. Amen to that. And folks, that's it for another episode. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter @FanExperienceCo, Instagram @FanExperience.co, and of course via our website at www.FanExperienceCo.com. So stay safe, stay positive, and we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye now.
The Fan Experience was recorded live. See you next time.